You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things.
Well, hello, welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today I have the great pleasure of speaking with Miguel Rivera. When you look at his bio, he is a musician. He is a sound editor. He is a sound and film video editor.
Film and television.
Has been doing that for many years. You can check out, I'll put it in the description. You can check out his IMDb. He's worked on all sorts of things that you've heard and all sorts of things that you haven't heard. Those are actually some of the most amazing. But I think for me, what is most interesting and probably where I'm gonna push us to go, Miguel is a ceremonialist. He is a teacher, but he teaches in ways that involve more than just words. And a lot of what he does is ceremonial, goes out of various indigenous cultures, et cetera, et cetera. And that's where I suspect we're going to spend the most amount of time, because is that the place where you spend the most amount of time, Miguel?
Yes and no. It's getting to be that way. It has at times in my life been a very dominant, expansive time, and it seems to contract and expand. Yeah. I'm never out of it, you know, in some form or out of it.
If you had your druthers, would that be what you were spending your time with mostly?
Yes, in a way, although it's exhausting sometimes to do the ceremonies, you know, because they require quite a bit of, they're challenging, you know, a lot of firewood. Sometimes we don't eat for days or sleep for days.
Yes.
Or don't eat any food. So those things are challenging. And then the preparation is very intense. So you're never really out of the ceremony. You're just in a different stage of it.
Yeah. And the other thing I want to make sure to say, and maybe you'll tell a brief story about that, but Miguel was born in Guatemala. He lived in both the United States and Guatemala. I think you came here finally when you were about 13. Is that true? Is that right?
Yes.
13. You grew up in your most formative childhood years, kind of living in what was a clinic and a hospital in Guatemala. Your dad was a surgeon. Your dad was from Guatemala. Your mom was from the United States originally. And so you grew up in this healing environment. And do you think that's what pulled you into the life that we were referring to, you know, being a person steeped in ceremony? Or was there a turn somewhere? You want to tell that story?
Well, it was interesting growing up in that kind of an environment, because every time somebody knocked at the door, it always had something to do with medicine. People were either looking for a doctor. I remember opening up the door many times. One time they brought it, there was a guy who had been hit by lightning. They brought a guy who'd been hit by lightning, and they were looking for the doctor, you know. Another time, I remember opening up the door, and there was a basket of food just sitting there, you know. Mm. Sometimes chickens would show up just in the yard, or a load of firewood, and we didn't know what the hell that was all about. Yeah. And I realized a lot, my father and my uncle, my father died when I was very young. My father died when I was 3 years old. But by that time, his practice had already been well established. And so a lot of times in Guatemala in particular, there's a lot of poverty. It always has been that way. And my father's policy was, if people didn't have the money, they didn't have to pay. Right. People would always pay back in some form or another. Yeah. So it was always a reciprocity there. It was unspoken.
So. And do you see the link between growing up in that environment and eventually being steeped in the various ceremonies, which we'll talk about in a bit, but or is there no link there?
Oh no, there's a total link. I mean, I know I was born, once I realized that was my environment, that was just the way I was. That was my purpose. I knew my purpose in life was to serve, heal, help people in some form or another. I didn't know which form it was going to take. It took me a while to figure it out.
And did you ever entertain the idea of going the conventional medical route and, you know, becoming a surgeon or what, becoming a medical doctor, et cetera, et cetera? Yeah.
Oh yes, definitely. I mean, I went to work, and before I came to the United States, my father had a clinic right in the front of the house. After his death, my mother built in the back part of the house. She built a small hospital, like 10 beds with an operating room and a nursery. And so everything was all healing. And then after the small hospital was built, my uncle, who was also a surgeon, came and took over the practice of the clinic. So he had the clinic, and then my mother ran the hospital in the back. I used to go with my uncle. My uncle used to take me. We'd go do rounds in the hospitals, in the big general hospital in our city. And then he would take me to do house calls with him, and I used to watch him operate. I was basically being mentored, you could say. Oh, wow. I was an apprenticeship. I remember that very strongly. So, and I always heard my aunts and everybody would say, you're going to be a surgeon just like your dad. So you just take it on, and there's a certain level of what you call primogeniture, right? That gets embedded. This is your inheritance. This is your father's, and the lineage comes from that. But also, one of my great grandfathers was also a musician, so that was in the back of the mind. You know, my grandmother was a concert pianist.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, she had there was a piano. She had a stroke early on in her life, and so she part of her side was paralyzed. That's what I remember my grandmother. But when we'd go back and visit the house after we had moved to the United States, I would find scores of Rachmaninoff piano concertos and that she could just whip out. You know, so that's all in there. But the reality of being in service or in some form in service to life or being able to help people was always. In the back of my mind, I went to work in a hospital when I was in high school. My last 2 years of high school, I worked as an orderly in an emergency room in upstate New York.
And that's I was going to say that's in the United States. By then, you moved to the United States. Yeah.
And then, but with the idea of eventually going to medical school.
Yeah. You know,
what was interesting in the hospital experience for me, I had already been in hospitals, you know, I knew how to play a part. So I was 16 years old when I went to work in the hospital, but I could play. People would come in and think that I was an intern. I could pass off. I knew how to hold space, you know, and so people would treat me as an intern, you know. So I realized one thing. What was interesting to me is the fact that a lot of this, not all of them, but many of the surgeons that were working in the emergency room were studying to be psychiatrists. So part of it to me, if you're a healer, right, you're always looking for where the root of the disease is. And so for surgeons, in many ways, it's all in the body, right? But these surgeons in particular were looking someplace else. Maybe it's in the mind or in someplace else. So that to me, that was a very, and I remember saying, this is interesting, you know, and that's in the back of my mind, you know?
Yeah. So briefly, tell me the leap. You're working in a hospital, you know, the whole family thing is pushing you or pulling you towards, you know, you're going to be a doctor, young man. and then what? Then how do you make the leap from there to what you're steeped in now, the kind of healing you're steeped in now?
Well, I realized that one of the things that after you recognize, if you do something over and over again, you begin to recognize patterns. And I remember my first job was to, they would leave me alone in the emergency room. And so, and when a person walked in, this is in the 60s, okay, 1969 to 71. So much different than it is today. But my job was to take names, addresses, insurance information. And if there was no doctor or nurse there, I call them immediately. So I was able to spend some time with each patient as they came in, if it wasn't too busy. And so after a while, I began to recognize what kind of energy people would carry when I would be filling out the paperwork. And I remember very distinctly, I was taking, there was a woman and I was taking all her information and I could just read it in her face. She felt safe. I am finally somewhere where I'm safe, you know? So a lot of people were looking for safety. And I realized made me think, what is going on in the homes? You know, why are these people letting awful things happen to them or do things to themselves so they can go somewhere to be safe?
Mm.
And coupled with the fact that not necessarily the root of the disease, why these doctors were studying to be psychiatrists, you know, you realize it's not necessarily all in the body, but it's someplace else. So there's a question of belonging to me. I couldn't quite, in those days, I didn't know what it was, but maybe the answer was not in doing it the way that was being done in that particular environment. So I knew something wasn't quite lined up in that particular configuration. So I figured out, and it was deeply, the best way that I could put it, it was probably in the culture. where things needed to be addressed on a much wider level, you know. So I got a scholarship to go to university at that point, the State University of New York. And so I made up a major of Latin American studies, which constituted history, anthropology, and cinema.
Well, you studied in Latin American, whatever, studies, Latin studies. And then what?
Then I had this is critical. My life got really complicated at that point. So I decided that I couldn't stay in school. So I actually took a leave of absence. But right before that, one of my cousins had a boyfriend that was Puerto Rican from New York, in New York City, right? And one day he showed up at the house and just brought me a conga. So that's how where my musical career, one of my brothers is a very good musician. So we were banging around guitars, playing saxophones and things like that, you know? But my friend Miguel came up, he brought a conga one time to my house and he goes, "This is for you." So he taught me how to play basic and we would just sit around and jam. So I had that already. So came time to some other conversation. I ended up having to leave school for a while, trying to figure out how I was going to get my life in order. And then I ended up moving, I was on my way to Orcas Island at one point, 1972. I decided to leave New York and go to Orcas Island. I had met this guy. He wanted to go to Orcas Island and we were going to go build looms. But sounded interesting to me because the life was very complicated.
Yeah.
I ended up in Colorado and I would tool around with my drum and go to parties. And eventually I met all these musicians. And I became friends with the guy who used to play bass for Spirit. His name is Mark Andes. And so we would tool around and eventually Mark started putting together a band.
I'm still waiting for that link though. How do you get from playing the congas in a band to...
What happened is I was long story short, I ended up joining this band that Mark Andes was starting, and we started touring around the country playing, and we'd go all over the place. We'd go to Detroit, go to all around Colorado, all the ski towns. We went to Austin, played a bunch of times. Eventually Dan Fogelberg used to come and hang out with us, and one time he brought this curly headed lady to watch this, and we had no idea. And about 3 months later, we get a call and it was Carole King. So all of a sudden, we're Carole King's backup band, you know. So we go, I'm in a van, you know, before I was on my way to Orcas Island to learn how to build.
Yeah,
Didn't make it to South Dakota either. The guy that Mark said, oh, he's going to show up any moment, you know, to teach you how to keep bees. Didn't happen. So I ended up joining the band. So, and about a year later, here we are on a car, drive van full of equipment going to LA to rehearse with Carole King to be her backup band. So eventually the band that we were in signed a deal with Capitol, right? But the music that we were doing at that point, we had become very interested in esoterica. So we were studying, reading all the Edgar Cayce books, all the Madame Blavatsky books, all the Theosophical Society books, all that stuff. Music, there was a lot of Music of the Spheres, Hazrat Inayat Khan, all those things about esoterica, about music and sound and how they're all linked up. And so the band, we wrote and composed and performed music to change people's consciousness. So we got an album deal through Capitol Records, right? And I was in New York. We had just finished a show at the Palladium. And I used to like to pack up all my gear because I knew the roadies. And when they would load the trucks, I knew.
Right.
So anyway, this woman comes up to me. And she goes, "Can I talk to you for a second?" And I go, "Sure." And she goes, "I want to thank you for saving my life." And I go, "How? Tell me about it." And she said, "I was going to kill myself." And I was walking around the streets of Manhattan, and I walked by a record store, and I saw the album cover, and I did something compelled me to buy it, and I started playing it over and over again. And then after I listened to the music several times, I decided not to kill myself. So I said, thank you. So I realized we had saved a life in a way through the music. And I realized, oh, so there's something in there. There's healing. This is even though conceptually we knew that this could work. This is an example to me that this actually can help, you know, can help people. So I got interested in figuring out how to make it. And the next thing is, I know I moved to LA to be a studio player. And after about a year of being here, this is 1979, 1980 sometime, I got a call from a friend of mine that used to own a studio in Topanga. And he said, I want you to come over here and play some tracks on some tracks. And there was a couple of Native women that wanted some Latin percussion on these Native chants. So I played on these tracks. And then they had a tape that they were promoting, you know, the recording. They wanted to promote the recordings at a multicultural gathering in Oxnard. And when I got there, the person, she was companion. I think she ended up marrying the gentleman that wrote the book Seven Arrows, which in the 70s was a very popular book. Yeah. Jaime O. Storm.
Yeah.
So, Chuck Storm, right? So I met Chuck Storm, and I used to give him conga lessons. So he invited me to come to Sweat Lodge, and so the drum essentially is taking me to many places. Through the drum, it opened up. At this gathering in Oxnard, some of the people that became my teachers I met, Evelyn Eaton was there. I don't know if you remember running into Evelyn Eaton. She spent a lot of time in the Owens Valley with a gentleman named Raymond Stone, who was an elder.
That name I remember.
Yeah, well, Evelyn was one of Raymond's, she'd vision quested with Raymond. And so I got very interested in somehow there was something unique. And at that time also, there was a couple other elders that were involved in, they wanted to find people, young people to teach, because they were all in their late 60s, early 70s, and they knew they were going to cross over and wanted to pass on. So we started a group here in LA.
Is this when you met Wallace Black Elk?
Marcellus Williams, also Sunbear. So we got invited. We started a group here in LA, and we would go out and run, help back them up, whatever they needed to, you know. So Wallace and his wife, Grace, and then Marcellus Williams, and then Sunbear. We went to several of the medicine.
I don't want to upend the story, but well, maybe even back in those days, you tell me, you know, certainly now there's a huge conversation about appropriating other cultures, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't want to dismiss it as if there is no such thing, but was there controversy at the time? Because I remember, you know, doing Sweat Lodge, being in Sweat Lodges, not running them. And hearing about people who were upset about it, but I don't know, was it controversial back then that non-Native people were not just in the lodge? Maybe that's controversial as well, but also sort of participating in bringing it about, whether it's fire keeping or whatever.
Well, it was controversial then, and it's still controversial now. So there's no question about it. But the reason, I mean, for me, what was interesting is that I was invited to come.
Yeah.
And it's not like I went out and read, there was a magazine that used to be called Shaman's Drum, and you could, in the back, I used to always look at the ads in Shaman's Drum, and they say, you become a shaman in three
years. Become a shaman.
I had already been, you know, in hospitals and emergency rooms, so I knew that whole deal, you know. So to me, it was a whole different perspective. It's about a position in life. And to me, and mostly for me growing up, I have to tell you, I never, because I'm from mixed heritage, I'm a Muslim, right? My father was from Guatemala, Maya, and Spanish ancestry, and God knows what else, because Spain was the doormat of the world for many, many years. I mean, the Phoenicians and the Romans and then the Muslims, you know. 700 years of Muslim colonization. So God knows what is in my blood, just alone from having some Spanish heritage. And then my mother being 100% Polish, right? My father, my grandfather.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, my grandfather left Poland in 1910, I think, or 1912, right before the Russians. Poland was the doormat of the world for many years between Germany and Russia, too. So he left. He didn't want to be there. They knew right before World War One, so he left because he knew the Russians were going to come in there and just.
Do you think you sort of got a pass because you were of mixed heritage, or no? Were there people who said, "What the hell are you doing here?"
Well, that's the interesting thing. Yes, I did, because I remember one time Marcellus Williams, he ended up becoming one of my grandfathers, said to me, we went to a Native American church roadman. And we went to, at that time, the National Conference of Native American Church. It was way up on the Lucachuca Mountains in northern Arizona. And he would say to me, he would take me out to the Navajo Reservation, and he would say to me, they can't figure out where you belong, so you're going to be all right. That's what he would say to me all the time. They can't figure you out, so you're going to be all right, you know. But yeah. The reality is, when I started participating, again, to go back to where we left before, I had never felt like I belonged anywhere in this world. You know, I grew up in Guatemala, being of mixed cultural identities in Guatemala. I never felt like I belonged there, even though I understood the culture, understood the land to a degree, and there's a lot of developmental stages there. But I thought it would be different when we came to the United States. It was worse. And so I never felt like I belonged in this planet, you know. And the first time I felt at home was I was about 27, 28 years old. And I went into a lodge with Wallace and Grace. And as soon as Grace, the clothes that, you know, brings the stone in, as soon as Grace started singing, it was the first time I actually felt at home on this earth, like I belonged here.
Was that the first sweat lodge you were ever in?
No. It was not my first lodge, but the first time I was in a lodge with Grace and Wallace. And when she started singing, something goes, oh, you're home now. You belong here. You belong on this earth, you know, which is really interesting. So I think the sense of alienation that most humans have is big, and they just can't put a finger on it, you know? So that's one of the things that made me realize there's important information here and these teachings that allow us to connect to the earth in many different forms, elemental through the elements, you know?
This is a question out of ignorance, or at least a question out of not knowing it, and it might be ignorant. So the teachings that you refer to, you know, it's a different culture in a different language, or some of it, a different language. Mm-hmm. And how did it become accessible to you?
They had a sense of legacy. They knew that their time was short on this earth, and they wanted to teach what they knew before passing on, and there was no young people in their communities to teach it to.
Yes. So
they said, who cares? So whoever shows up, this is who I'm going to teach it to, you know, and they needed to pass it on. And when you look at the ceremonies, at least the way we were taught, is that everything is inclusive. Nothing is excluded, especially when you look, especially at the medicine wheel teachings, every single species of human, right? Every single species of plants and animals, all the elements, everything, organic, non-organic, it's all included. It's all, if anything is not there, then it's not a true ceremony, you know? Mm-hmm. So no matter how you look at it, you have to figure out how to invite. It's not a complete system of.
Clearly it was important to you. And you've spent a big chunk of your time, energy, effort immersed in it and sharing it and offering it to others. So there's a strong feeling that it's important, not just to you. I'm genuinely asking, this is not a challenging, it's not intended to be a challenge in any way, but why do you think it's important beyond, like, why is it important for people to give a shit about ceremony? Why should anybody care?
Well, for a number of reasons. For instance, when we were when we got started, it was 1980, right? And during the 80s, I didn't understand this completely until much, much later, but things were said to me, in particular, after my first vision quest, you know, when I...
Explain just briefly so that people understand. What is a vision quest?
A vision quest is a ceremonial fast normally undertaken when a young person is getting ready to make a transition from childhood into adulthood. So it's a way to understand what your purpose is, a way to find out what your purpose in life is, and also to introduce you. It works on many different levels, but it also makes a transition from the ages, right, or the sponsorship of the physical mother and the physical father to the community father and the community mother and the universal mother and the universal father. So you make a clear cut line of that this stage of development is over and you're going to transition into a new one. So it's a finished conversation. So it's a clearly line of demarcation that you are no longer a child. You're a young adult now with different responsibilities and different commitments in your life, right? And also what your purpose is in life.
So, what you just described has grown out of the evolution of a culture for hundreds, maybe thousands of years. And why is it important in a world where that culture, you know, you're bringing it to a different culture where it hasn't grown organically from that. Why is that a good thing? Why does that matter? What is it for?
There's a number of reasons. One of them is it connects you, right, to the world that you live in a very much different way, because it changes, it de-objectifies the relationship to the world. It makes it a personal relationship. So the fire is no longer an idea. It's not just a metaphor. It's not just a symbol. It's not just an academic position, but it's a living, breathing entity. And it actually connects you to the world in a personal, it's about relationship. So it cultivates reciprocity and accountability, right? Mm. So that means that if you're in, it's a relationship, then all of a sudden it's not an objectified. When you objectify the life around you or the world around you or those around you, you're not accountable to them because you can treat them as things instead of beings, you know? So it changes your relationship. And in that time, the political, what I was going to say is at the first vision quest, right? One of the things that was said to me is things will happen to you now that it will take you 20 or 30 years to understand. So just remember what happened here, and later on it'll make sense. The other thing that happened to us, there was a series of developmental, they took us through steps. First, we started with pipe ceremony, sweat lodge, and vision quest, and then Sundance, right? And also teepee meetings. But for me, what was interesting is the second year that we were Sundancing, in particular, the Sundance is just another very intense.
And you were permitted to dance?
Yes, we were permitted to dance. We were one of the first. This is in the 80s. My first year dancing was 1984. Second year, 1985. And we started in Denver. Then we moved the dance to Pilot Rock in Oregon, outside of Ashland. And what it's important is to realize that you see colors, right? When you see a medicine wheel, it has six colors: black, red, yellow, white, blue, and green. So that means if you take one of the colors out, the ceremony is not complete. So that means that all the races are represented. So that means that there has to be representation of all the races in there. That's one of the teachings, right? But also what's important is to realize that when we were Sundancing the second year, I think at that time in the 80s, the big idea is to celebrate the 500 year anniversary of Columbus, right? The arrival. And for a lot of Native people, that's a disastrous, it's a terrible, tragic thing.
It's not a celebration.
So, no, it's not, you know, so it was, so I remember the intercessor at that time, who was Wallace, said, your people could not do this with us when they first came over here 500 years ago. On their behalf, you're doing it now. That went, like, it's still to this day, it affects me, even as I'm saying it to you now, the potency of those words, because we have to do retroactive rituals to allow us to communicate and also to learn from each other, you know? Each major race, each ethnic group has medicine, has a connection to spirit, a connection to source. And we all have to gift each other with how we connect to spirit.
Is that your response or a response or a coherent response to the conversation about appropriation?
Eventually, yeah, because we're doing it, we have to learn. They were educating us as how to be reciprocal with the earth, you know? So at that point, we're earning, we're just not appropriating, but we're fulfilling our obligations to the earth as human beings, you know, which culturally hasn't happened. All the old ways of being in relationship to the earth got basically slammed. So we have to be retaught we have to learn how to be in reciprocity to the earth, you know. So by participating in the ceremonies, we have to remember what our roots are, you know. And to me, there's earth business, right? I mean, I've been conducting ceremonies for well over 40 years, and I realized that a lot of the things were beyond our scope of, we as humans, we have a very limited, narrow scope about how the universe works. It's true. And it's mysterious how it operates, but the universe has a very strange sense of humor. I did a wedding one time. I have a lot of stories about this, but I'll tell you a couple. A friend of mine was a Chicano activist here in the 70s in LA, you know, and he said he would never, I said, he was telling me this in his own words, you know, he said, I vowed I would never, ever talk to a Gabacho ever in my life again. I was never going to talk to a white person ever. And then my knucklehead son falls in love with a white woman. These are his words. And he goes, and I'm holding my first grandchild, and he's got blue eyes and blonde hair, and I cannot help but love him. And he said that with tears in his eyes, you know? And I took that in, and I realized, oh, love. You know, when you hear the old corny love will find a way, this is, people are falling in love with each other, mm-hmm. and cuts across all ethnic groups. And I've seen it over and over again. And so we have to learn how to love each other as humans, you know? So that's part of what's happening.
I for years, so I was at this school that we had a little bit of history of, right. And the kids, and it was quite diverse by intention, right? I mean, that was the mission, was like, look, we got to try and figure out how the things that have historically kept us apart will bring us together. So it was quite specifically that the kids had so little trouble, right? It was easy for them to cross the lines, way easier for them than for the older people. Right. And I think one of the things that is so sometimes so troubling at this for me at this moment, you know, as we're sort of steeped in, and I don't know if it's real or if it's just hyped up by the news, the culture wars and the identity wars. And it's like, it's almost like reversing. Young people are no longer, it's like they're trying to move away from the ease that they had. Just being with one another. To them, it was natural. Like, what are you talking about? You know, what's the problem? And now it feels like there's a searching for a problem. And it is a very troubling thing, which may be why I'm so focused on your work with ceremony, and especially your work with ceremony that is from, quote, another culture. But it's not like you... I don't want to take over this conversation, but it's not like you know, you're working for Coca-Cola and you decided the best way to do a, you know, a Coke ad is to use a sweat lodge, and somebody gets out of a sweat lodge and takes a Coca-Cola. That's okay. I understand that's appropriation, but you're doing it by moving through the teachings of that culture. It is not about your blood or your heritage. It is about your doing the work of really coming to understand, in some ways that take 30 years, 40 years, understand what that is. And I can't imagine that would be appropriation. And yet,
it's not. And when you really think about it, because it's about... there was a gentleman whose name is Albert Whitehat, who was a great Lakota elder. I don't know if you knew Albert, but he used to come. We used to sweat with him. He used to come to LA once a year to run lodges. And he'd say to us, you know, you guys come in here not because you want to be Indians, but because you want to be better human beings.
Right.
You know? And so that's the quest for us is, I mean, we're humans first. Men and women and everything in between afterwards. And then come all the ethnic groups and all the socioeconomic practices. When you reduce it to that way. So we have to reclaim ourselves as beings, human beings in a larger community of beings, which includes all the plants, all the animals, all the elementals, organic and inorganic, and all those things. So we have to go back and connect in some form to source, you know? So that's what we have to do, untangle from all this craziness that we have inherited for hundreds, if not thousands of years, and we keep repeating the pattern. We have amnesiacs. We're these terrible amnesiacs, and we get to a certain point in our developmental stages, and we forget, you know, what happened 70 years ago, what happened, you know, and there's like,
Do you think it's possible, you've been doing this a long time, do you think it's possible for somebody to think their way to this understanding?
Thinking is not necessarily, I think you have to think about doing. I've been mentoring kids since 1995. So one of my young kids, one of my mentees decided he wanted to be a warrior. So he joined the Marines in 1998. So we sent him off and he ended up spending two tours in Iraq. And when he came back, it was a frigging mess, you know. I think it was maybe three tours, and we had to figure out how to put him back together again. So eventually I got to meet veterans, people who had been in and out of Vietnam, in and out of Korea, World War II. And one of them was he was from Montana. He was Salish Kootenai. And Roger, his name was Roger Schwartz, and dearly, dearly beloved brother, you know. And so we got invited to go to Hawaii to run retreats for combat veterans in Hana, you know. And we got to meet some of the, and so I have a relationship with the elders in Hana. And one of them said to me, he got in my face, and he goes, "Why are you doing this?" And I said two things. He goes, "Listen, I'm not even a vet." And I said, "But people are dying, and I have to do something about it." And also the other thing, remembering what Wallace's words were, right? You know, about your people couldn't do this with us 500 years ago when they first, I said, because is this, the guy who was in my face, his name is Kyle, dearly good bro, good friend, but scary because he's very intense, you know. He'd been military, he's fireman in the Air Force, you know, he'd been a fireman in Hawaii all his life, you know, and very intense warrior culture. But when he's looking at me, he's thinking, these guys are just another bunch of missionaries from the mainland trying to tell us people what to do. And I said, that's not what we're here to do. I said, we're here together to recreate the coming together of the cultures the way it ought to have happened, not the way that it did. Mm. And he took a long pause and looked at me and he goes, "Cool." That's all he said. Cool. And I'm going, this is what's important, is to go back and then figure out, this is why the reciprocal or retroactive ceremonies are really important, because we have to figure out our ancestors did not know how to get along with each other, and if we're honest about it. And so we keep passing that on, and we have to model how to create cohesive cooperation with everybody, because everybody has a gift. My friend, we're going to get into the poetry at some point in time, but I've been wrapped up with poetry for many, many years. But my friend Humberto Acabal, who was a Maya Quiche poet from Guatemala, he said this in a poem: "Roots tell us through the flowers what the earth is like on the inside." Mm.
I read that because you sent me stuff, and I just love that.
And that's a powerful line. And then the next line, he goes, "And the flowers, they wither and they die because life out here is shit." But that first line, that was a poem about the political life in Guatemala during the 70s and the 80s, right? Which is, but you think about it. But the beauty of that, it goes, we are all like these roots. We have our own unique root to mystery, right? And so we have to go back and remember what it's like to be connected to source without any interference, nothing in between. So this is what this is about, the interpretation of the teachings to the next levels, for allowing us to connect to source directly without any interference, right, of any system or thought process that's going to compound or complicate the relationship, you know. And this is how we have to come together as
because it's important to be in right relationship to everything.
So everything, yeah. And that means that our relationship, you are viable, I am viable, and how we are connected to source makes us all viable when we come together and bring it. So that connection to spirit is a gift. It's, you know, right? So
in your travels, Brad, so your understandings have grown out of a certain cultural ceremonies.
Yeah.
You've bumped into other ceremonies that are not the ones that you necessarily practice. Does Does it matter? I mean,
I don't think so. No, I mean, because of my drummer, you know, I ended up hanging out with all these Africans, you know, and I had a teacher that was Nigerian who's still alive today, Ayo Adeyemi, you know, and I played with him for 12 years. And my brother, and he did, I've talked to him a couple of months ago. He goes, "You are still my brother." And I realized that, and I've done a bunch of African ceremonies, you know, Yoruba, Dagara ceremonies, hours and hours and hours. And you realize that at some point in time, when the connection to source is intrinsic, right? But how it manifests itself in one part of the world is different than the other part of the world. But when you look at it, it's just a different way of getting there. But at the same time, it's still a connection to source, you know?
And have you ever found ceremonies that that feel like it's about connection to source, and yet they're not rooted in indigenous, I don't know what word to use, they're not rooted in earth proximate cultures?
So by some point in time, a lot of these churches are all about accumulation of wealth and power, but they're nothing right. about relationship to the earth and accountability or participation, and there's no reciprocity. That's the big thing about all these religious movements. It's all about leaving this world and not putting things back into this world, you know. Look at all what's happening with ayahuasca right now and all the plant medicines. I think it's a commodification of relationship to the earth that doesn't take any accountability. I have a dear friend of mine. She knew she was going to die. It's a much longer story, but this is only part of it. She knew she was going to die. So she was an avid gardener. So she had herself cremated. And then part of the memorial services, we put her ashes, we put them in her backyard, right in the middle. Because every single plant and tree that was all in her backyard, they all flowered. And the idea was that she knew that all those roots eventually would eat of her ashes. And so when they would flower, her essence or her elements would be in. So her husband, who survived there, who's still alive to this day, when he would look out there and see those flowers, he knew that he'd be receiving her. And that, to me, what a gift, you know, to be
amazing.
Wanted to be part of nature in that way, and it's not a common thing in the culture, you know. When we take, but we never give, and in particular in death we don't even participate with the world in that way, you know.
Right.
So that's a huge teaching that we have to impart to people, how to cultivate reciprocity with the earth. And that's a lot of it is it's embedded in those teachings. But the reason why we were taught the way we were is because we had to transpose, right, or reinterpret it for the times now, how to be reciprocal, not only with the earth, but with each other, you know, what our obligations are to this planet. And part of it is cultivating gratitude, you know. Thank you for being alive. Thank you for being provided. Nature, out of its own accord, is incredibly generous.
Unbelievable.
I've never seen an orange tree give you one slice of orange, you know. It gives you 300 oranges. Take as many as you want, or don't take any, but here they are. And nature.
So given that, how does a person make a living?
How do you make a living? Well, you have to get clever, you know. So that's why I started, because I realized that, you know, I've made a living. I mean, I've been everything. I've been an orderly, I've been an agricultural worker, I've driven a cab, I worked on cars, I've built houses, I do whatever. And so that's why I got into post for film and television, because I had to pay the bills, you know. So I remember one time this woman that I know, they hired me to run sweats for a rehab facility here in LA. And she said, "This is not the old days, you know. 500 years ago or 300 years ago, there would have been food at your door, just like there was in Guatemala, you know. People knew, people were educated, they understood what their responsibilities were for the work that was done, and you would be provided for. So she goes, "You have to let me know what you need, and that way I will take care of you." So that's one way to do it, you know. But and so you have to figure out. I mean, I've been fortunate enough that some people understand that. So I've been given grants, I've been gifted from time to time, because I'm not supposed to charge for anything that I do.
But no, I was going to say, isn't there at least everything that I bump into is not, you don't charge for what you do.
No, I so it's either it gets gifted or at some point in time. So and that's I gotta buy food. My son's going to college. All that, but somehow it works out in some form or another. You know, so that's different.
Oh, you know, it's taken you some interesting places, and you know, you'll have a life of, as a musician, a life as a sound editor, a life as a person, a ceremonial, a life as a translator. So
yes,
how much of that and. And I know you're also doing rites of passage work with kids.
Yes, yeah.
So how did the translation thing happen?
Translation, I got invited because I'm a drummer, right? I got invited to go started teaching at the men's conferences. I met Michael Mead. Michael Mead invited me to go to Mendocino and could participate. They had wanted to make the men's conferences at the height of Iron John, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right at the height of Iron John, Michael Mead, Robert Bly and Michael Mead did a Day for Men in LA. I think it was 1989 or 90, somewhere in there. And I knew one of the organizers and they said, bring your drums. So I said, okay. So I played. And at the end of the day, it was like 700 guys there and they rounded up all the ethnics. This is my version of it. Okay. So they said, would you guys, they said, come here, would you like to go meet James Hillman and Michael Mead? I said, sure. So we ended up going to a magic shop right on Hollywood Boulevard. It's still there, upstairs room. And there's Michael Mead and James Hillman. And they were talking about how they're doing these men's conferences. And they wanted to make it more multicultural and would we be interested. And there was a couple of Asian friends that are my friends to this day. There was a couple of black guys, a couple of Latino guys, and a couple of white guys. And they said, yeah, sure. You know, we agreed to spend the weekend together. And if we didn't kill each other, we would help them. So we did. We spent a weekend together. And I have friends that own land in Malibu. I think you know Eric and Mary, right? You know,
Yeah.
We went up there. That's how I met Eric and Mary. And then Michael Mead said, if you want to see what their retreats are like, come to Mendocino. So I went to Mendocino that following summer. And at the end of the retreat, he said, what do you think? And I said, I like it. But I said, you guys do this backwards. At that time, I had already spent, you know, five or six vision quests, five Sundances. And I said, you guys do this backwards. You sit around and you talk for 5 days and then you pray for 5 minutes. I'm used to praying for 5 days and then talking about it for 5 minutes. So we agreed.
But they got it, right?
So it was like a big thing, you know, so I'm going, so... Anyway, so somewhere in there, this is 1989-90, you know. So I ended up going to Mendocino, and then Robert Bly called Michael and said, we need to make the Robert Bly's conferences. Also, he said, who do you recommend? So I ended up getting a call from Robert Bly, and I got invited to go to his conferences. I went to one in Mendocino, it was the first one was in Montana, actually, the Great Mother.
To have some sort of role? Like what?
To teach drumming. But the conferences, because Robert is such a big poetry, is a huge part of the conferences, you know.
Yeah. So
my sister had given me a book of Humberto Acabal's poetry. And so I just would read it on this. I started going to Robert's I got automatically invited to all of Robert's events. So I started going to Minnesota that year. That was 92, I think. I started going to Minnesota. I've been going to Minnesota since 1992. So and on the fly, my sister gave me a copy of one of Humberto's first. It was his second book, and the poetry to me was like unbelievable. So as soon as I started reading it, I was like transported to some world of my youth that connected me with incredible experiences with nature. You know, especially very elemental, which is the native way of being. And so,
poetry written in Spanish.
Humberto was Quiche, Maya Quiche, right? So he wrote his poetry in Quiche originally, and then he translated it to Spanish. And then on the fly at these retreats, and especially in Minnesota, I would just read it. I would translate on the fly. So the green book that I sent you, the PDF of, was him saying, yeah, that's how the translation got started. Yeah. I've translated all his work, all his poems, and then I have another book out through Tia Chucha Press that Luis Rodriguez helped me publish too. So yeah, and that continues, you know. So Humberto did his own version of the Popol Vuh, which is one of the Maya creation stories, the main Maya creation stories. So I'm working on a translation of that. I'm about halfway through the Popol Vuh right now. So which is another, it's a huge piece right now because based on all the work of Joseph Campbell and all that stuff, you know, it's really critical you know, in some ways to better the world, you know, to make it all important, you know. So
how are we doing? You're spending a lot of time working hard at making the world a better place. How's it going?
Well, I have a lot of hope right now. You know, I do. I really do. And I think that in my sense, when we started,
you said right now.
Right now. Yeah, I do. Because of the way I see the caliber of kids that are being born. And there's a lot of hope for the youth. However, what's really important is to teach the model holding space for the youth. The youth have no experience that there's actually viable elders in the culture, you know? This is why there's no respect. And to me, the anger, I was trying to understand the anger, why there was so much anger, especially when I grew up in the 60s. And you see, we were so angry because the level of irresponsibility that the adults had about themselves and the world, you know, I couldn't put it into those kind of words then. Mm-hmm. Then I understood the issue of legacy, you know, and when you see, especially when the punks started coming out in the 80s and in the 90s. And I understood that. I said, when they realized the size of the pile of shit that they were being left over, no wonder they're angry. And they have a right to be angry. What kind of crap is that? If I realize that's my inheritance. So my job is to let them know that they can be, that there's somebody reflecting. I didn't have a wrinkled up old gray hair blessing me when I was a kid directly. I mean, I had a lot of, there was a lot of beautiful, I was gifted a lot when I was a kid by uncles and elders that somehow gave me help and gave me hope, but not a direct relationship with somebody who embraced me, you know? And so my job is to look at a youth directly and say, I'm blessing you right now. I'm blessing you right now because I know that you can be a wrinkled up by gray hair like me, blessing somebody like I'm blessing you. I want you to be a grandfather, you know. So
where do you do that? Talk about it. Can you talk about your work with youth?
We started a group with Orlin Bishop here in the
90s. No kidding.
Yeah, Orlin and I have been. Orlin was one of the original guys of that crew that showed up at Eric and Mary. We started a group. Orlin started a group, and the first batch of kids that came through Shade Tree, they would come once a month to do sweat lodges. And a lot of them we're still in relationship today with them 30 some odd years later or whatever, you know. So the work is that continues to change and modify over the years, you know. So one of the things that came out of that is rites of passage. So we're doing these retreats for youth where you basically isolate them for a number of days. And so we're slowly working up the methodology is how to come and create the proper ceremonies, because you have to have a very intense ritual aspect to it. But how it gets created has to be through time. One of the things that I learned from Raymond Stone, who was a Paiute medicine man who taught grandmother Edith, you know, he said, everything that we are comes from the earth. If we lose it, we go back to the earth and the earth will tell us. So this is what we're doing. We have to stop and stay and spend time enough with the earth and figure out what the ceremonies that need to be created, pulling from the threads that we carry from a tradition that we come from, you know? So
do you actually take youth out to?
Yes, take them out and basically start spending time in nature with them and then create dances and basic ceremony, learning how to, we teach the kids how to build fire. Right. It's as simple as that. Sitting around fire. And what are the responsibilities of handling fire? How do you handle water? How do you handle earth? How do you handle? But fire is the most important one. You know, teaching kids how to build fire is critical. How to handle tools, you know, how to deal with a knife, the responsibility of carrying a knife. What's the responsibility of carrying fire? And there's a lot. You talk about days and days and days and years of understanding how to take care of fire. And this is where we start, you know.
And do you work with them for years? Do you work with them for months?
It's a lifetime commitment, you know. That's what I tell them anyway. It's up to, I'm with you until either I go or you go. And like I said, a lot of these kids that we started working with in 1995, that was the first year of a Shade Tree.
Yeah.
I still, to this day, I know many of them.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful.
A lot of them have gone on to become sun dancers. They run lodges. They're lawyers. Some of them are lawyers. Some of them are healthcare workers. Some of them are, you know, they all have married and kids and have taught. They work with some of the kids. Some of the guys work with Homeboy Industries, Anti-Recidivism Coalition, you know.
And do they ever Do you ever, like, you know, for lack of a better term, is there ever a reunion?
We meet each other from time to time.
You do.
But yeah, we've been talking about it to get everybody together. It sort of happened last, there was a national conference for restorative justice groups in Chicago last summer. So that was like some of them were met there, you know, like Luis Rodriguez was there, Orlin was there. We hung out for a week in Chicago. We've worked together loosely with each other for years, mentoring the same kids and everything, but we actually got to hang out in Chicago, you know, so it was great. But you realize we all do the work. We just don't have enough time to hang out with each other and really visit. Yeah. But it's an important thing. But everybody carries out the work in their own particular way. It's impossible for one person to do it all, you know. So you have to.
And are you still working with the young kids? I mean, like,
We did. When the pandemic started, I worked with Youth Mentoring Connection, Tony Lorenz Group, Rhythm Arts Alliance, Street Poets are the three groups that I work with here in LA, ARC, Anti-Recidivism Coalition. And we do a week, a yearly retreat in the hills, you know, depending on the schedule. But also we have surfing. So for the last 2.5, almost 3 years, they've been surfing every Sunday morning. We go to one of the beaches and the mentoring is there and it's open and it becomes very ceremonial in its own way, you know. So it's active and it takes place and it's open. So
what does that mean, ceremonial in its own way?
It's just holding the ceremony, you know, just by showing up and holding place, you give people a sense of continuity and the sense that they belong there without any constrictions, you know, without any restrictions at all whatsoever. From learning the ceremonies, one of the first things that I learned from, especially running sweats, that the old people used to say, you showed up, great. That's the most important thing, is that you showed up. Whether you participate or not, that doesn't matter. You showed up. So a lot of times people would come to the lodge and just show up but not do anything. And just the fact that I had to learn how to appreciate the fact that people just show up and how to be included and not necessarily, that alone in itself is participation. Mm-hmm. And by holding space, for instance, a lot of the kids that we work with don't have viable parenting. One of my friends that I met through the years said that he's been working with incarcerated youth to prepare them for release, right? So one of the things that I called him up and I said, if you were to see a world with no prisons, what would be your recommendation? And he said two words to me: better parenting. And that to me, like, if there was a mission, right, for me, there's a couple of things that are important but one of them, what I've learned is the role, we go back to what I was talking about earlier, the connection to the universal father and the universal mother, which are archetypal energies, and to restore the integrity of the office of the father and the office of the mother, not only in the culture, but in the world, because they don't exist right now. These are archetypes that are not living, breathing. One of the friends that we had, that weekend that we had in Malibu, right, with going back to that story about how I met Hillman and me.
Yeah.
One of our friends, his name was Dadisi Sanyika, and Dadisi had studied, there was a center in Watts called the Aquarian Study Center, run by Alfred Lagan. It was very beautiful, incredible. And he was very esoteric, but it was all African, you know, Afrocentric in some ways, but they were open to everything. So I had a conversation with the DC one time, and he was talking to me about Atlantean fire, Lemurian fire, you know, all these ceremonial fires that he knew about. And I said to him, did you guys ever go out and build a fire? And he said, no, I just about fell out of my chair. I'm going, so the idea, right, or the symbol, the metaphor.
These Jews matches.
But that's how we are as a culture. You know, we're so incredibly avarice for information. Yeah. But we don't metabolize it.
Yeah.
You know? So it has to be, we super saturated the RAM, but it doesn't get metabolized in some form, you know? So you got to go out and start figuring out how to digest it, how to chew it up and, you know, excrete and what doesn't work and put it back in the earth and figure out how to use it. But that's a huge piece. And that was one of the things that we learned through ceremony, is how these archetypal energies are living, breathing things that have to be activated. And that's the beauty of this. You see a resonance. It doesn't matter where you go in the world. You know, they are doing it in principle. It's the same thing. It's just done physically, you know, in a whole different manner, you know, but the concepts are the same. It's very, to use the word, plastic in that way, that it can be, it's malleable, you know,
yes,
have right. a formula. but it has, you have to learn how to work with it because mm-hmm. it manifests itself differently every time, you know.
The stuff with the youth sounds really rich. And that, you know, the absence of, obviously you're not the only person who speaks about that, but the absence of what used to be, you know, a rite of passage of some yeah. sort, of some sort, are going to sort of a marking of time and acknowledgement that your life is different after this moment, something you are moving into some different space. And, you know, I have a friend years ago who says, now it's like, you know, now you get a credit card and a car and here you go. That's it. That's,
yeah, and
that's
they don't keep,
of passage.
It's, I mean, I had a one of the retreats we did in Minnesota years ago. I'll tell you, I don't talk about this very, it was one of those magical things. We were out there by the lake. Everybody had prepared gifts. And the kids, at one point in time, there was about 10 or 15 kids, all about 15, 16 years old, you know, and they wanted to do something. So one of the kids had been with Martin, so he knew how to make a spirit canoe. So he said, can we make one? And I said, yeah, Martin Prechtel. So I said, yeah, go do it. And so everybody had prepared gifts, you know, but I didn't know. I was the only adult that knew about the canoe, you know. So we had all the guys had prepared gifts. We knew all these songs. So we're out there by a lake, you know, everybody's gathered. It's about 120 guys, 150 guys all chanting and singing and everything. And it was one of those things that I'll never see this again. But as you look out the lake, right, we're standing there lined up beside the lake. And on one side, there's a flock of eagles flying, you know, on another side, there's a thunderstorm. And then on the other side, there's a rainbow, you know, all happening at the same moment. Wow. The thunder, you know, the thunderhead, where you can see the lightning bolts in the distance, you know, the flock of eagles and then the rainbow. And then we're chanting away, rah, rah, rah. And everybody's lined up to put their gifts in the water and the gifts. And I can see the reflection, the water sparkling, you know, how it water shines in the lake when the light is the right way. And the gifts are floating out there that all the guys had prepared. So, and I had a row of elders lined up, you know. And so one of the kids, I said, go get the canoe. I gave the command so the kids all take off and they come out with this canoe, you know, this beautiful spirit canoe made out of reeds and flowers. And it was so beautiful. And this is all happening at the same time. And so everybody goes, wow, the energy gets rises up and the frenzy. And I see the row of elders. I see them on their foreheads. I say, those little fuckers, how come they get to do this and I didn't get to do that, you know? And I turn around and I said to them, you bless those guys by blessing yourself, by blessing them. You're blessing yourselves when you were that age. And all the guys teared up. And you realize most of the men, most of the grownups are still stuck in some formative developmental stage. And you know that old saying, act your age, not your shoe size.
Yeah.
That's what it's about. You know, all these cliche, well, this is what that means. You know, you're still stuck. You haven't been blessed. You never got blessed when you were 4 years old. You never got blessed when you were 16 years old,
yeah.
especially by an elder or a teacher, right? Yeah. So that's there so significant.
There is that, whatever that is, that fracture, that tendency is like, hey, when I was young, I had to blah, 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 whatever it is, and it sucked. And they want somebody else to go through it. They're like, wait a second. It sucked. Why would you want somebody else to go through it?
Exactly. Why would you want to repeat that? Because that's what you're teaching, you know? Right. That's what we have to change, you know? Yeah. That kind of continuity. Yeah.
It's
that,
so
you know,
stingy. It's such a stingy way of walking through the world. And what a moment for those people.
Yeah, but I realize now it's really important. And you have to figure out, when I see somebody, I'm talking to, how old are you? You know, are you a 4-year-old? Are you a 2-year-old? Yeah. I mean, I have a lot of stories about that. Yeah, it's true. And so you have to realize, am I a 4-year-old that's watching my father either beat my mother or beat me, you know, when I'm functioning?
Yeah.
You know, that's critical. And that's true in there. So you have to go back. And to me, one of the things that I've learned, especially working, I work for 15 years or so with people in recovery, is you have to make them feel at home and you have to put blessing on them. I cannot tell you how many times I've heard people in the lodge say, I never felt like I belonged on this earth until I came into this lodge tonight. You know, I've seen it over and over and over again.
And do you think it's the lodge or do you think it's the space created that, you know, not that the lodge is trivial, but that it's really because because of how you hold the lodge, you create the space that gives whatever counts as the blessing.
Yes, yes, that's true. It's both. But it's understanding how the lodge works, you know, and what are the principles. Like, you have to, when you light fire, what's all involved? What are the stories that all related to fire? For us, for me in particular, and this is taking me many, many years to figure this out. When you light a fire, you're reenacting the creation of the universe, right? Mm-hmm. And also you're reenacting the conception of the individuals in the lodge in particular, right? When the stones, you reenact the conception. The stone becomes sperm, the lodge becomes the egg. Mm-hmm. Inside conception, inside gestation, emergence, birth.
And the emerging come out. Yes. That's, yeah. And do you still do lodges?
We've resumed again, slowly but surely. A lot of it, because of the pandemic, we had to stop.
You know? Sure.
So now everybody, when we do lodges, everybody tests the day, or they are due before in small quantities. Yes, we can go back. But what's important is the whole ceremony with the principles. Once you understand that about fire, you can say anytime you light fire, you can make fire in that way and put that and call that blessing in and work with those energies. It's not the same. It doesn't have the same impact because it's out in the dark. It's very dramatic when you have the stones coming in, you have fire, and we have to learn how to use fire. There's so many fire restrictions, in particular here in the West Coast, because of the fire danger. We have to learn how to heat stones up with propane because the fire is contained, you know, because it's so dry here. It's crazy. Yeah. So that in itself is a huge compromise, but I'd rather run sweats with, and people are going to give me flack about it, but we have the blessing of our medicine man elder right now. Do it, you know, and I'd rather go in there and pray than not to pray at all, you know. But I've seen traditional people take advantage of people, you know. I have a lot of stories about, you know, people on the reservation running sun dances for Germans and bringing them in and charging thousands of dollars for each people to come in. Oh, yeah. So just because you're native doesn't mean that you're clean. You're well, still.
That's the thing, right? I mean,
that's the thing.
That's the thing that, you know, is the hardest thing to have a conversation about in this world these days is that, like, look, it can't be that, you know, it's like whatever your blood type is.
No,
right. Your DNA is what makes you virtuous.
No,
there's a name for that, and it's not a good one.
it's like a thing about, you know, what is it in AA? You know, when you talk to the old crocodiles, they say if you're an asshole when you're drunk, you're still going to be an asshole when you're sober. So right. But to me, what I say to people is, we're humans, right? And as all humans, we all do the same thing. We all lie, we cheat, we steal, we bless, we make good food, we make good. We all do that. So we have to get used to the fact that it's common to all of us. Yes. And I don't care whether you're male or female, whether you're black, white, red, yellow, blue, green, pinstripe, polka dot. You still you have to do the internal work to go back to the revolutionary movements in Latin America, right? To tie it back to that. They all failed miserably because all the leaders did not do the internal work required to hold office in that capacity. That's what you see. All of them. Look at all the guerrillero
movements. Oh, my God. It was like
all of them. And I'm going.
I remember being so disappointed because what's his name? Daniel Ortega, right?
Yeah.
Denise is like, oh, wait, and all of a sudden he turned into that. She's like, you gotta be kidding me.
What the, you know, like WTF, a big one with capital. I mean, all the guys in Guatemala after the peace accords in 96, the next government that came in, the level of corruption that got formalized, which is unbelievable. And it's still a downward spiral. It hasn't recovered. I'm going, what a travesty.
Unbelievable,
you know. Well, I see it.
Yeah, that just means you have more work to do.
But that to me, so at the end of the day, my hunch in 1972 was correct. You have to really work on the individual. So it has to be a really looking at what's happening in the culture, you know. To me, like the biggest, the one of the big problems is the lack of accountability on the Catholic Church. I'm going to go after the Catholic Church because I'm a former Catholic. So I can say that, you know.
You get to do
how
it.
Can, right, yeah, I can do it. But it's true for almost all Christians, you know, most all of them. I'm not saying that all of them, but when you look at like in Guatemala, right, let's go Catholics first, right? The John Paul, the Polish Pope, I forget what his name was.
Yeah.
John, one of those. he was going to go to Merida for the first time in 1990. I can't remember what when that was, you know. And so the Archbishop of Merida said, "You should apologize for what happened during the when the during the conquest, because they came and the Inquisition was full. When you read the accounts of what they did, what horrible. The Inquisition did, just freaking horrible. And the Doctrine of Discovery, right? Oh, they killed." And he said, "You should apologize to the natives." They fired him. They excommunicated him. And I'm going, what the? The Pope comes to, he goes to Argentina, and all those generals, you never not once called them to account for all the slaughter that they did of people in the 90s in Argentina. All he said to them, don't use birth control. I'm going, what a coward. And when you look at the atrocities, we were in Santorini. I got invited to do a wedding in Santorini in 1996. And what happened in those days, they were bombing the crap out of that. And the fighter planes would come in. They were based in Spain. They would come into Santorini to refuel before they went on to Serbia or Kosovo and drop the bombs. And when you see a fully loaded fighter bomber come in, is a scary thing. So, and how can you go sit in a church and pretend to be a Christian and still be responsible for the deaths of thousands? That's beyond my capacity. You know, I'm going, this is something's wrong with these people, you know. So that's all goes back to the politics, you know, how to become accountable for what we do, you know. I want to say thank you for inviting me to talk with you. I feel like we got a lot more to talk about, but it doesn't matter.
Exactly.
I'm happy to part two. But I think it's important. There's a couple of things that to how to get back to the love, you know, how to get back to the love. And I'll go back to Umberto's poems, right? The Roots poems. He said, right, roots tell us through the flowers what the earth is like on the inside. So with that in mind, he had another one that said this: for a long time, I've loved you like the roots that with all of the power of the earth love until they burst into flower. So to me, I would say find that love. Find your root and figure out how to love so that you can burst into flower and some form, and then gift with each other. And he had another poem that said to open up the earth with your hands, get filled with its scent, raise your face to the sky and eat the wind. That is peace. So I would end with those, you know, sit with the earth and let the earth inform you. Let the earth tell you what, and tell your story to the earth and hear the story of the earth. I think this is what we have to just start doing, is just to stop and to listen. Yeah. So this is what we have to teach, you know, how to stop and how to listen, and then figure out how do we participate. So to me, go back. So let's figure out how to be still enough so that we can connect with that original state of.
Well, Miguel, what a pleasure. What a pleasure. All right, my friend. I don't know
when we
see each other next, but we will see each other next.
I believe next month or something like that. But great. Thank you, David, for everything.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Bueno.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.